You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Migration matters. It has risen to near the top of concerns expressed in opinion polls in the UK and across Europe. For many politicians, the EU referendum result was a clear instruction from the British people that they wanted to reduce migration levels. But is it all as clear-cut as that? Joining us today are Daniel Pryor, Head of Programmes at the Adam Smith Institute, and Christian Niemitz, Head of Health and Welfare at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Daniel and Christian examine how people in Britain really feel about migration and where the nuances lie. They discuss the economic benefits of migration and its impact on culture and social cohesion. Finally, they lay out their migration policies in an ideal world and examine approaches that might be compatible with public opinion. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. It's often very difficult to separate fact from fiction in the immigration debate. And it's also very hard to separate out emotion from what is both an economic argument and also one that relates deeply to issues of culture and national identity. So Christian, obviously you're an immigrant in this country. I would like to ask you how you think people in Britain generally perceive migration. You know, on the one hand, we voted to leave, which clearly had quite a lot to do with immigration. But on the other hand, as we've seen with the recent Windrush scandal, when faced with the consequences of a really draconian approach, people seemed absolutely appalled by it.
Yes, there's an interesting division. The surveys are quite clear on this. If you ask people about immigration in the abstract, you get the impression that attitudes are extremely negative. So, for example, up to 70% say there has been too much immigration in recent years and decades. And there's a relative majority saying immigration has been mostly bad for the country. So if you ask in those very broad abstract terms, you get the impression that attitudes are very negative. But if you then ask more specific questions, you get much greater differentiation. There are large groups of immigrants that very few people have a problem with and that most people have very positive attitudes towards. So it depends on, firstly, skill level. That is a big differentiator. Highly skilled immigration is actually very positive, that most people are in favor of at least the current level or more skilled immigrants than we have now. Students coming here, again, not an issue at all. There's also a lot of variation by country of origin. So there's a clear pattern here. Very few people have a problem with people from developed English-speaking countries coming here, for Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Most people are in favor of completely free movement even. To a lesser extent, that is also true for Western Europeans. Less approval here than for Canadians and Australians, but still very positive. Eastern Europeans, it's a bit more mixed. And then places like Pakistan, Turkey, Africa, their attitudes are very negative. There's a lot of variation on the basis of skill level and country of origin. The trouble with current immigration policies is that it makes life very hard for those groups of immigrants that are actually very popular. Highly skilled immigrants, the best example, probably. As a skilled immigrant, you can get a so-called Tier 2 general visa. For those, there are very high hurdles, but the numbers are also capped at ridiculously low levels. That's the reason why, in recent months, the Home Office has rejected a lot of applications from doctors, engineers, and so forth. Really, the type of immigrant that even critics of migration are generally in favour of.
So we're kind of adopting a policy that is the worst of all possible worlds, in that we are clamping down on these popular groups of migrants, inflicting a lot of economic damage for very little
yes.
political gain. So it makes no sense. Why do you think that governments have been adopting these what seem to be extremely counterintuitive policies?
They probably just misread public opinion. They think the public is just universally hostile to all immigration and that just signalling that you're tough on immigration will produce political gains. But it doesn't necessarily. It may at a very abstract level. If you talk about, as David Cameron did, just about crude numbers, getting it down to tens of thousands, when you get those headlines about doctors being rejected, engineers being rejected, and for different reasons, the Windrush scandals, that is very unpopular. So there are clearly groups of immigrants that very few people have a problem with. Those are the ones that we're making life hardest for.
In the same way that governments clearly think that the British public is a lot more xenophobic and hostile to immigration than they actually are, there's a big difference between wanting to kind of draw up the drawbridges, so to speak, and just the feeling that your government is somehow in control of things like migration numbers.
Yes, although Here we have breakdowns where Leave voters specifically were asked what were your main concerns, and immigration really is in at least the top three, possibly even number one. So that is not completely wrong. But even here, there's a lot of variation. There are surveys where people are asked, from which countries would you be happy to accept more immigrants, or at least the current level? And it shows again, almost nobody has a problem with Western Europeans coming here. With Eastern Europe, there's more differentiation with the most recent countries to join the EU. Their immigrations are most hostile. But there is this idea that after Brexit, we have to have one single immigration policy for the whole of the EU. That isn't true. You could keep free movement for Western Europeans and have a different system for the recent accession countries.
Another thing I'd like to talk about was something that I'm sure you've both done lots of research on in the past, which is the housing crisis. Whichever way you look at it, a lot of the population increase that we've seen in recent decades is attributable to migration. And of course, all these people have to live somewhere. Arguably, this is also compounded by the fact that immigrants tend to settle in London and the South East. What impact has it had on our housing shortage?
Can't put a number on it, but it must have made it worse. There's no question about that. But what I would argue is simply that if we had a more sensible housing policy, the impact could have been zero. There are examples of places where the population is growing fast, such as Tokyo, in this case not because of international migration, but because of internal migration from within Japan. But Tokyo growing, the population growing at high rates, and house prices nonetheless staying relatively flat. And that's simply because they have a more sensible housing policy. They build sufficient numbers of houses. That's something that we should do either way, and this should be separated from the immigration debate. Because even if we completely hermetically sealed the borders, it would still be the case that we already have some of the highest house prices in the world, and that's something that we have to address either way. And this is something that started with purely domestic drivers, such as rising life expectancy and smaller household size, the decline of the multi-generation household, average household size being now 2.1, 2.2, much smaller than it used to be in earlier decades. Of course, that is driving up demand, as well as rising incomes, people demanding more space. That's something that would happen even if you had zero migration. Immigration compounds that impact, amplifies it, but the responses either way are the same. The response that we should take, which is to liberalize the land use planning system and build a lot more houses. And we can see actually that the systematic increase in house prices started already in at least the mid-1990s, if not earlier. And that was before we had this big increase in migration from Eastern Europe related to them joining the EU. So this is something that was already well underway, which would have to be addressed either way.
Just to follow on from that, I think Christian's hit the nail on the head. If you have very inelastic housing supply, as we do, then of course you're going to get population increases translating into higher house prices and lower affordability and higher rents. At the same time, the actual magnitude of immigration's impact on house prices, whilst it's something that's often kind of referred to as one of the big evils of mass migration, actually it's not anywhere near as big as the kind of impacts that we have from planning restrictions, from other kind of regulations on the housing market like that. Professor Paul Cheshire went through the kind of estimates and tried to estimate the magnitude and found that planning restrictions had a far, far greater impact than any sort of population increase from migration.
Yeah, and once you start going down that road saying we have to restrict migration because of house prices, you would actually have a stronger case for restricting internal migration. You would have to stop people from moving from the north of England to Oxford, Cambridge and London. You would have to have a system of internal passports like in Cuba. I doubt whether anyone, except maybe Simon Jenkins, but apart from people like him, I doubt that's where we want to go.
Sort of another Hadrian's Wall type scenario.
Multiple overlapping ones.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's true. There's definitely, in the Conservative Party at least, there does seem to be a change of appetite towards this. But in general, I think it's much easier to kick the can down the road on this and blame the problem, leave it in the corner of immigration rather than making the changes that are needed. And of course, that fits in very well with general Conservative opinion, because there are lots of people that are not going to benefit from planning liberalisation because it may see the value of their house going down. Daniel, is there evidence that migration has a depressive effect on wages?
The impact of migration on wages in the UK is fairly minimal and in some cases positive. The only real evidence of a negative impact, and it's very small, about 1 penny per hour in your wage is on the lowest paid workers. And that kind of research has been led by Jonathan Portes from KCL. And he's kind of very clear that whilst this effect is important, the actual magnitude of it is extremely small. And the same actually goes for jobs themselves. There's this kind of idea of the lump of labour fallacy, where suddenly if you get a large influx of extra labour into the workforce, what you're going to get is less jobs for natives, whereas of course that forgets that immigrants actually demand goods and services as well as supply them. And I think a good illustrative example of why this lump of labour fallacy is in fact a fallacy is the entry of women into the workforce throughout the 20th century. You didn't see the kind of job displacement there when women entered the workforce, and you don't see it with immigration as well.
The whole immigrants took our jobs thing, it's become a bit of almost a meme, like a stick which is used to beat or to mischaracterise people who are against immigration. But as with wages, what matters less than the actual evidence is the fact that people seem to really believe that that is the case. Why do you think that so many people feel this way, even if it doesn't actually stack up to reality?
Well, I'm actually a bit cynical when it comes to the idea that the economic arguments are the kind of strongest part of people's opposition to migration, immigration in general. When you look at the kind of recent survey evidence of this for the UK population, it does seem as though things like taking jobs, wages, fiscal costs are the primary concerns for the population. And there's some evidence to suggest that a small number of people actually are open to changing their minds if they're convinced by the economic evidence of the various benefits of migration. But I actually think that for most people, those kind of economic concerns are actually secondary and less important than some of the cultural concerns, which is kind of alarming for me as someone who is very interested in the economics of it and is very much thinking that that's the most important part. And actually, a lot of the cultural issues you find with migration, whilst they exist, are often overplayed and need to be weighted against the economic benefits of migration as well.
You guys are both economists. It's very difficult to measure how people feel about things, and you can't really come up with a model or a graph that measures how people feel, their sense of community. You know, David Goodhart's thesis about the somewheres and anywheres. This is all quite intangible, quite intractable stuff, but nevertheless really matters.
Well, one of the interesting things that we've tried to do at the ASI, the Adam Smith Institute, is look at these more intangible factors and see, as good neoliberals, if we can quantify them in some sense and kind of study them and make sense of them. And the closest we've come so far is a paper we released a few years ago now called The Ties That Bind. And that's kind of a review of the evidence of the effects of migration and immigration on social cohesion, things like social trust, civic participation, those sort of measures. And what that found, it was a review of evidence from Europe and America and, of course, the UK, was that there wasn't a very strong effect either way of immigration overall on social cohesion. There's really no conclusive evidence that diversity in UK communities creates a negative impact on social cohesion. So, and in fact, in London, sometimes there was evidence of a positive impact.
So was the report looking all across the UK?
Yeah, so it was looking at the UK, but also at evidence from Europe and the United States as well. And obviously those have kind of different approaches to immigration and different cultural factors as well that may play in. But the results themselves are pretty consistent across most of Europe, the UK and the US.
That's interesting. I went to school in Birmingham, where I felt that extremely difficult to measure these things, but I felt like there were some communities that were extremely segregated. There was very little social cohesion in some of these places. But then, having spent the last few years living in London, it seems to me like a much more cohesive environment. And I suppose it really does work better in some parts of the UK than others. That seems to accord with what happened with the Brexit vote. People in London didn't necessarily know people who voted Leave, and they didn't necessarily know parts of Britain where immigration has created losers as well as winners.
Yeah, I think you could be right there. And I mean, I used to be someone who was very much of the integrationist bent. In other words, I thought that it's very important that as soon as people arrive in Britain from a different country as economic migrants or whatever else that may be, then they need to be put into a kind of British community, native British community, and kind of integrate through that way. But actually, some of the things that I've been reading about recently, looking at the evidence of how ethnic conclaves work for immigrants, is that there seems to be this benefit of someone arriving in their own cultural group within the UK and being able to find a job and integrate through the labour market that way and use their kind of cultural connections they already have. And then once they've been able to do that, transition into more mainstream British society. Now, whether that works all the time is another matter. And as you say, there are certainly cases across the UK where that process could be enhanced. But actually, I found that in the UK, our comparatively flexible labour market is pretty good at integrating a lot of people. Labour markets and flexible labour markets are absolutely vital for making sure that people do that. So another benefit of immigration in terms of the economic side of things, it actually deepens the division of labour. And this is even true of very low-skilled immigration. A couple of economists, Foged and Giovanni Perry, looked at this when there was a refugee influx in Denmark, and they found that it kind of pushed the low-skilled natives into better positions, and they actually end up complementing each other, low-skilled refugee and the low-skilled natives. And another benefit that I think is talked about in the US, but there isn't as much research for the UK, is that immigrants tend to be extremely entrepreneurial, and they tend to increase the amount of innovation in an economy. In the US, there's evidence that highly skilled immigration, at the very least, has increased patent activity, which is a pretty good proxy for how much innovation is going on in a particular society. And we're currently working on a paper with the Entrepreneurs Network, which is our sister think tank, trying to look at the effects of immigration on entrepreneurship in the UK. When you look at the stock market, the big companies in the US, you find that a very much a disproportionate amount are founded or created in some way by immigrants.
I'd quite like to go back to Brexit, which we've touched on. The vote to leave the EU was based on a myriad of different factors, but clearly immigration was a big part of it. What I'm interested in from both of you is how you would create an immigration policy, because clearly there is an appetite for border control that is economically sensible, but also politically possible.
So there's a few different options for this. Some of them have already been taken off the table, like points-based approaches, for example, and good for people who look good on paper, but they don't regard for employers' needs. If you look at something like a visa lottery, whilst I personally think that would be a fantastic policy that we should introduce, it's very unlikely to win any public support.
Sorry, what is a visa lottery exactly?
So it's basically randomised allocation of visas regardless of income or other factors that we'd usually discriminate on the basis of. So it's kind of geared towards actually helping the lower skilled migrants, which is obviously a kind of big concern of people's. And one of the biggest benefits of migration from a neoliberal perspective is actually its effect on global poverty and on the poorest in the world. But like I said, realistically, that's not something that's going to fly with the UK public. That's fair enough and understandable. Now, another option is to simply extend our current tiered system to EU countries as well, but that would deprive businesses of vital workers and skills that they need. There's still problems with our current system. So what we've proposed very recently, earlier this year, is a visa auction system. And it basically involves letting employers bid for a limited number of work permits. So the underlying idea for this is to introduce market demand into the process of migration and let migration be determined by what employers and what the market demands. So it fulfills those skills gaps.
Christian, what policy would you take?
The trouble with points-based system is that it's very much a form of central planning of the labour force. It's the idea that some government agency can predict the skill mix that the labour force should have in 5 years' time or whenever. It's especially odd when people on our side, on the free market side of the argument, make that point, because they would never accept it in any other sector. They would never accept, let's say, a points-based system for imports, where some government department estimates consumer needs in 2022 and then allows imports on that basis. Clearly, that is something that we can only reveal through the purchases that we make, and in the same way, whether some type of skill is needed can only be found out by allowing somebody in, allowing them to offer that skill and see if somebody purchases it, if employers want it. Points-based systems seem to be based on the idea that somebody arrives here with a fixed set of skills and then they apply those skills. That may be true for some groups. Maybe that's you could say that that's what doctors and nurses do. But generally speaking, it's much more realistic to assume that people come here, maybe initially with very little skills, and then build up a skill portfolio by working here. that most skills are actually learned on the job. You may have a university degree or something before. That's more an entry ticket. Your actual skills are something that you build up, and especially the more country-specific skills, here would be, of course, English language skills, that's something where it makes much more sense for people to be here and build up those skills here. Imagine somebody trying to teach themselves English by watching YouTube tutorials whilst living in Poland, and then coming here, that makes no sense. It's a much smarter option for those people to come here, get a job, learn English while they're on the job. Ideally, after Brexit, I would keep free movement. I think it's been a huge success in aggregate terms, at least. It's pretty clear that migrants from the European Economic Area are net fiscal contributors. For other groups of immigrants, it depends on how exactly you allocate fixed costs and how you model it. For European migrants, it's perfectly clear. Whichever way you specify the model, the outcome is always the same. Those people have been, in aggregate terms, net contributors, and they also integrate easily, especially probably because they have such high rates of labour market participation, mostly speak English already when they arrive. So these are clearly among the least problematic groups to integrate both economically and culturally. I don't see a case for introducing additional border and migration bureaucracy to control a group of people that doesn't need to be controlled, where it already works quite well. Keeping free movement doesn't have to mean that you just keep the status quo. There are actually things that can be done to limit the type of migration that people have a problem with. And that was always the case. If you ask people who oppose free movement of people within Europe, if you ask them, what exactly is your problem with it? Do you think there's too many French bankers coming here? Unsurprisingly, they will say, no, it's not about French bankers. It's Romanian beggars that I have a problem with. Those people could already be deported. Free movement as it stands was never unconditional. You have no unconditional right to go to settle anywhere in Europe where you want to. What you have to do is exercise treaty rights, meaning that you have to either work or study, live on independent means. People who aren't doing that can be deported under free movement rules. That's something that the British government could have done the whole time, but chose not to do. Well, some other European countries do it.
But it might just be that it was far too difficult to enforce. Hugely overblown in the media, but there have definitely been thousands of cases of students who've left without paying a penny for their studies here in Britain.
Okay, that would be a matter for the student loan system, that student loan company is bad at tracking international payments. More generally, on the enforcement of whether somebody's exercising treaty rights, that can be done. But you would then have to have a system where people have to register. That's the way it works in Switzerland. Switzerland is part of the free movement zone, even though they're not in the European Economic Area. But if you move to Switzerland as, say, a British national, you have to register within 2 weeks with an immigration office. You have to apply for a residence and work permit. The numbers here are not capped. That's why it still counts as free movement. If you have a work contract, that permit cannot be refused. But if you're not exercising treaty rights, if you are the sort of person that critics of free movement have a problem with, then you can be removed, and it does happen.
I guess more generally, is free movement, is it compatible with the generous welfare system, particularly when you're dealing with countries that have extremely different entitlements and privileges to us?
I think that it is. Immigrants to the UK tend to be net fiscal contributors in almost every group of immigrants. In fact, basically every group of immigrants since the year 2000 is a net fiscal contributor, and that's because they tend to take out less in welfare payments overall. Obviously, if you break it down and make it more granular, you could find some connections that go the opposite way, but as an aggregate, that's true. And also, they tend to pay more in tax. Now, I think the kind of strongest objection I've come across to that argument is really that immigrants tend to be younger people of working age, and that actually, if we look at the kind of long-run fiscal calculations, and what we're going to find is that they're going to need to take out pensions as well, and therefore in the end they're going to become either net fiscal losses, shall we say, or they're going to break even at best. Now, I think that's true to a certain extent, but it also forgets that immigration flows are a long-run thing as well. So, okay, if we shut the doors completely tomorrow and sealed ourselves off from the rest of the world, there wouldn't be any sort of replacement flows coming in of other young immigrants in order to balance that out. But yeah. I don't think that's obviously going to happen.
Yeah. So. Japan is really struggling at the moment from having adopted decades of this very isolated immigration policy.
Another big argument, one which perhaps we as free marketeers, libertarians, have tended to ignore, is the cultural argument. Because, you know, of course, people don't measure the impact of migration in pounds and pence. And there's also some evidence that high levels of diversity can erode cooperation, lead to lower levels of trust. Would you accept some of these concerns?
I think that some of those concerns are valid. There's a good argument that Brian Kaplan, the George Mason economist, talks about when people bring up this idea that, OK, you want free markets in labour, but that's going to somehow undermine the sort of liberal norms that lead to free markets in other areas. Now, let's just say for the sake of argument that that's completely true. Restricting the free market in labour is such a huge imposition and state interference that it would require an enormous counterbalance of statism as a result in order to make it a net loss for freedom. If you think about the scale of the restrictions that the state places on free movement, if you look at Michael Clemens, for example, another economist in this area, he estimates, and it's quite a popular estimate, that open borders could double world GDP or roundabout. So that's the sort of scale of losses to wealth creation and economic freedom that we're looking at. Even if you accept all of the arguments about that, and I don't, but even if you do, you still have a really big mountain to climb in terms of the net effect on freedom.
So when we're talking about those kind of problems, assimilation, self-segregating communities, this is often a matter of second generation immigrants. This is not something that can address with current migration policy. The worry that I have is that people see some of those communities where integration clearly hasn't worked and then jump to the conclusion that we need generally a more restrictive policy and that we then restrict migration for groups where that clearly is not an issue. We talk about second generation, this group, that group, but my guess is that we will never talk about second generation Poles, the children of people who came from Poland 10 years ago when Poland joined the EU, will just be Brits with a Slavic sounding surname. To somehow restrict immigration now from places where people integrate easily, from Poland, from Lithuania, and so on, is the wrong response to problems that have nothing to do with that.
So it's sort of cutting off our nose to spite our face, sort of thing. You've mentioned that it could be hugely beneficial for world GDP. I guess on an international level, you get what you see with immigration in Britain. There is a broad gain for society, but then there are small groups of people that lose out. And a big group of people that lose out from migration is those left behind in some cases. The brain drain is a serious issue.
When you think about the issue of brain drain, you need to have two other things in mind. The first is that from the evidence I've seen, it's completely outweighed in terms of the impact on the original country by remittances. In other words, immigrants sending money back to their families and friends in their home country. And that's actually an extremely effective form of international development. And there's also the flip side of brain gain as well, where you mentioned earlier some international students that go back to their host countries, and whilst it'd be very nice if they actually paid their fees, as you mentioned, one of the things that they do, which is positive, is when they go back, they bring back the kind of human capital and skills that they've learnt here in Britain or wherever they've migrated to. So whilst brain drain is a phenomenon that's worth thinking about, I think in international development terms, it's outweighed by remittances and brain gain as well.
I think we'll have to end it there. Thank you both so much.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.